Well, good morning, Creekside. Good morning. My name is Paul. I'm one of the elders or pastors here. Good? Okay. Happy Mother's Day. I don't always preach on Mother's Day, but when I do, we try and pick a horrible and depressing text for me to present. So, welcome. Steve, our regular preaching pastor, is out of town for a few weeks, so that's why I'm filling in. And I appreciate Jake's work on Sunday last week. He set me up well as he taught through Ecclesiastes chapter 2. And one of the things he did, and I really appreciate this when people do it, is that he connected the text to his own experience and talked about how struggling with work, which is one of the things that the pastor talks about in the text, was really meaningful to him because he struggles at work. And I appreciate that kind of honesty, especially the boldness of it, the fact that Jake works here. And everybody he works with was here, and he got to use a spiritual, you know, opportunity to tell them, you know, how horrible they make his life. So that was nice. So by way of introduction for me this morning, I'm going to say something that may endear me to some of you and horribly offend others, and that's that I generally strongly dislike country or Christian music radio stations. And it's not just because, like a lot of music, there is someone who learned 3 chords and 10 words and made a song out of it. It's because there's something in me that finds the theme that they present, this like total encouragement, total joy, life is great theme, totally repulsive. And lots of Christian books, movies, media pick up on this theme where, well, life was bad, but then I went to church and I prayed once and someone bought me a new truck and my football team won every game and my marriage became easy. And that's not at best how life really works. And at worst, it's a terribly destructive theology known as prosperity theology or prosperity gospel that teaches that, hey, if life is going good for you, that must mean God's pleased with you and you're close to God. And if life is tough, then it must mean the opposite, that God is displeased with you and you're not close to God. And so these movies and songs that I'm talking about don't deal accurately with the hard things of life. And I know that that's not universally true, that some artists do a great job of dealing with the tough things of life. So it's not universal, and I have high regard for those that do, but the encouragement theme, the reason it grates on my spirit, partly is I'm critical by nature. It makes me good at my job. I'm an engineer. It makes me a good engineer and a bad friend. But it's also why I love the Bible, because it's not some slick salesman that ignores, you know, plasters on a grin and ignores reality. It deals with the honest and hard and difficult things of life. And in this life that we live, where sometimes the evil get rich and the righteous suffer, and everything doesn't actually always work out the way that we wish it would. Some books of the Bible, though, are more unvarnished in their look under the hood than others, and Ecclesiastes is one of them. This book that we're studying is one of those books that deals with the raw, red meat of life. And this book, the Bible is still relevant after thousands of years. This book, depending on how you want to think about authorship, is 2,500 to 3,000 years old. But it's candid about life and has the answers to really tough questions. But it also, the Bible's relevant because it offers hope in these questions. So as we study together this morning, I hope you'll see that life is indeed hard and difficult to explain at times, but there is beauty and hope if you know where to look. So I'm going to read our text this morning. It's Ecclesiastes chapter 3. We're going to go 1 through 15 if you want to turn there. I think Steve said it best the other week. If you're not familiar with the Bible and you do the big flip method, it's in with next to Psalms, which is one of the biggest books about in the middle of the Bible. If you go to the right, a couple books, your Proverbs and Ecclesiastes, and you'll find it there. So this is what the preacher of Ecclesiastes has for us this morning. For everything there is a season and a time for every matter under heaven, a time to be born and a time to die, a time to plant and a time to pluck up what is planted, a time to kill and a time to heal, a time to break down and a time to build up, a time to weep and a time to laugh, a time to mourn and a time to dance, a time to cast away stones and a time to gather stones together, a time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing, a time to seek and a time to lose, a time to keep and a time to cast away, a time to tear and a time to sow, a time to keep silence and a time to speak, a time to love and a time to hate, a time for war and a time for peace. What gain has the worker from his toil? I have seen the business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. He has made everything beautiful in its time. Also, he has put eternity into the hearts of men, yet so that he cannot find out what God has done from the beginning to the end. I perceive that there is nothing better for them than to be joyful and to do good as long as they live. Also, that everyone should eat and drink and take pleasure in all of his toil. This is God's gift to man. I perceive that whatever God does endures forever. Nothing can be added to it nor taken away from it. God has done it so that people fear before him. That which is already has been, that which is to be already has been, and God seeks what has been driven away. Let me pray. Lord Jesus, we thank you for your word to us. We thank you for the honesty with which it deals with life. And as we study through it together this morning, I pray that you'll illuminate your word for us in a way that connects with our hearts. In your name we pray, Lord Jesus Christ. Amen. So I've got an older translation, and I skipped some words in there. After every one of those phrases, it says turn, turn, turn. And if it's in the original Greek, if you're old enough to get that reference, you probably also know how to write in cursive and drive a stick shift. And if you don't get those things, don't worry. Those are the methods we're going to use to escape when you put us in the old folks' home. But this book, as I read through it, it occurred to me that this section of Ecclesiastes is laid out like a scientific paper. And I read them for work quite frequently. Maybe you read one in high school or something. Maybe you're not familiar with it at all. But the way a scientific paper is structured is it's always the same, where they lay out a hypothesis or a theory in the start of the paper, and then they do some work, and they provide evidence to either support or refute their theory, and they come to a conclusion at the end. And so to me, this text is structured in the same way, and that's how we're going to examine it. And in verse 1, he lays out his thesis, this idea behind the section. For everything there is a season, in a time for every matter under heaven. And to me, these are different things, seasons and matters. A season is something that denotes a regular pattern of timing and occurrence. You can predict it. It's regular. You can prepare, plan, execute for it. Here in the Willamette Valley, it's almost time for the farmers to bale their hay and to put it away, and then we'll pick pears and apples towards the fall. These are seasons we can predict, we can be ready for. Matters, on the other hand, are occurrences. They're likely, maybe even definitely going to happen, but the timing is random and unknown. You have to take it as it comes. He says there's a time for all of these things. And in verse 2 through 8, he lays out a number of these concepts, and this is his evidence for his theory. It's one of the most famous poems in the Bible, maybe even in all of human history. And he lays these things out, and they come in pairs. And the pairs kind of paint a spectrum. And then there's a second pair that corresponds with the first that reinforces that idea and phrases it in a little different way. So they come in quads. And you'll see this as we go through. And I'm going to slow down, because a lot of times when you read through a biblical text like this, you can go, season for this and that, and I get it, and you skip to the end of that section. But I want to slow down, because I think if we do, it'll illuminate some things, and we'll get the full view of what he's trying to teach us. So in verse 2, he hits the extremes off the bat, birth and death. Now, generally speaking, these would be matters. You don't have any control over either in a natural course of things. You don't control your birth date. I have 6 kids, and like Aaron said, I can't speak from experience, but I know that pregnant women would also like that control, but don't get it. You don't control your birth weight, your birth sex, the amount of hair that you have. These are physical facts of how you're born. You don't control whether you're born in the hospital or the car on the way there, whether you're born early in the morning, late at night. You control none of it. Similarly with death, you don't control it. Are you going to go peacefully in your sleep like your grandfather, or screaming like all the passengers in his car? Slow burn for some of you. You'll get it. All right. Are you going to go at the end of a long life as expected, or shockingly and tragically way too young? Will your death be meaningful? Maybe you were fighting for your country in a righteous cause as a soldier, or meaningless? You were killed by that careless driver that can't keep their eyes on the road and their hands off their phone. Will it be painless or painful, disease or old age? We can agree that death comes for us all, but how, when? No one can say. It's a matter. It happens. He couples this with agriculture, which is a similar concept, right? Planting is similar to death. Planting is similar to birth. Plucking up is similar to death. And this is what I mean by there's pairs and pairs of pairs. They go together. This is a season that can be anticipated and known. It's getting to be planting time in the Northwest. It's getting warm. It's time to till up the garden, get your veggies in the ground. I'm a forester. We put our seedlings in the ground a couple of months ago because that's the proper time to do the planting. And then harvest happens on these typical seasons. We can predict this. It's a pattern of life. And then verse 3 is likewise extreme, and it may press on the consciences of some. He says there's a time to kill and a time to heal. that this may not be what you think of as typical biblical fare, but you might be a soldier fighting for your country, called to protect others. Or perhaps you're attacked. There is a time to kill. I'm going to use World War II as like, think of war as the extreme end of this. Sometimes evil needs to be addressed. It can't be asked to stop. It can't be given stuff till it goes away. It has to be dealt with. There's also a time to heal, to put down the swords. And this mirrors the second half of this text, a time to break down and a time to build up. In war, you blow a bunch of stuff up, right? But there's a time to rebuild. In World War II, Japan and Germany were the mortal enemies of this country, and we destroyed their countries. But afterwards, we helped them to rebuild both countries. Now they're number 3 and 4 economies in the world and some of our strongest allies, that there's a time for these things. And you can relate this to personal relationships in a similar way. In verse 4 goes on, there's a time to weep and a time to laugh, a time to mourn and a time to dance. There's times in life where you're going to experience intense emotions. There's seasons in life where there is nothing to do but weep. You lose your mom. You lose your job. You're betrayed by a good friend. It's time to weep and it's time to mourn. And then there's seasons in life where there's nothing to do but laugh and dance. I met with a young couple in this church to talk about their membership here a couple weeks back. And they've got a young daughter. I think she was 7 months old, if I recall. And she's got 3 teeth, and she's nothing but grins. And so I was just smiling at an idiot like her, like, during the whole meeting. Because you have to. It's state law, and I didn't want to get in trouble. But sometimes there's a time to be joyful. Like, as a parent, you know, you see your son or daughter in a difficult situation and kind of of their own accord, they make the difficult but right choice. It's a time to rejoice. Or you get the promotion or bonus, or you see God move in your life or in somebody else's life in a big way. In our house, we have a tradition where we celebrate the wins. I mean, sometimes they're regular, like Mother's Day or birthdays, but sometimes it's, you know, you got a good grade or you had a good game in sports or you know, something happened, because life is short. So we celebrate the wins and enjoy that season. And then verse 5, cast away stones and gather them together. Now, this takes a little more homework, perhaps, because it's not intuitive to our day and age. And part of that is we live in the Northwest. Lots of you like the outdoors and hiking and that sort of things. This is not talking about collecting a bunch of rocks and stacking them in a pile on the mountain. You dirty hippies, stop doing that. Okay? In multiple commentaries I read, and there's also a biblical account in 2 Kings chapter 3, this has more to do with an invading army going into the land of their enemy and throwing out stones in their agricultural fields. And it was a way of ruining the food supply of your enemy and ruining their ability to fight. And then when the war is over, you got to get those rocks back out of the field to make it useful for planting and for growing things. And he couples this with embracing or not embracing. You know, are we enemies or allies? Are we at war or peace, friend or foe? There are people in your life that you need to draw near to you. They're good for you. They give you good counsel. They support you. They provide friendship. There's also people that you need to not embrace and keep at a distance. Maybe they just bring conflict into your life or pain or difficulty. And sometimes over the course of your life, this can be the same person, depending on the season as it goes. In verse 6, he tells us that there's a time to seek and a time to lose, a time to keep and a time to cast away. You know, when you're young, you want everything. I'm old enough, I still remember getting the Sears catalog in the mail about Christmas time, and it was full of all sorts of shiny plastic, and I thought I should have all of it, right? But as you get older, you know, you get asked, what do you want for your birthday? You're like, I don't know. I don't really need anything. How about some good socks? And I know that's a lame answer, but it's okay, because as you get older, you don't care about being lame either. But the truth is, you kind of go, well, I don't need anything. As I got, you know, as I grew up and I went to college, I'd go see my grandfather occasionally, and he was getting to that stage of life where he didn't use anything in his workshop anymore. He wasn't using, he'd try and give me all this sort of stuff. But I lived in an apartment. I'm like, I can't take any of this. But as you go through life, there are times where we're takers and there's times where we're givers. I remember several times we've got young kids and people would give us hand-me-down clothes and toys, and what a blessing that was, because, you know, there was times where that's the way that we got through life. But sometimes, you know, the kids grow up and you're like, I don't need size, you know, 18 months anymore. They're all beyond that. There's a time to keep and a time to cast away. Verse 7, a time to tear and a time to sow. In ancient Jewish tradition, you see this all the time in the Bible, or something horrible happens. They tear their clothes as a sign of grief and sit in the ashes. And there's a time for tearing and a time for grief. But then there's a time to put your life back together and sew it up and move on. There's a time for silence and a time to speak. You know, your wife asks you, does this dress make me look fat? No, there is no good answer to that question. No, you look nice. Just nice! Oh, you're gorgeous. Oh, now I know you're lying. Right? Trust me, younger men, you are stone deaf and your tongue was removed if that question comes up. But sometimes all someone needs is silence. All they need is your presence. They don't need you to fix it. They don't need you to give them some great verse. They just need your presence, and silence is the answer. Sometimes they do need your advice, and maybe you have something useful and something helpful to say. Or sometimes you really don't have anything wise to say, or maybe because the emotional state, you're going to say something foolish, it's probably best to keep silent. Or you're in a situation where something's plainly wrong. It's something you weren't even involved in, but somebody has to speak up. Somebody has to say something. There's these times in life. And then we get to the final couple of phrases there in verse 8. And there's something that happens here in the text, and I want you to see it. A time to love and a time to hate. Again, this might not be typical biblical fare. I get a time for love. You know, God is love, but a time for hate? See, we're all made in the image and likeness of God. We all indelibly bear the character of our Creator, and He loves all men. We're called to the same. But He's also righteous and cannot bear sin. And when we see sin in others or in us, you know, anger and this hate of it is the right response. And sometimes the Bible has things to say that may surprise you. So let's go ahead and throw up Psalm 5 there, which says this, "For you are not a God who delights in wickedness. Evil may not dwell with you. The boastful shall not stand before your eyes. You hate all evildoers. You destroy those that speak lies. The Lord abhors the bloodthirsty and deceitful man. But I, through the abundance of your steadfast love, will enter your house." Jesus, in Luke 14, tells us to follow him. We must hate our mother and father. Happy Mother's Day. But there's a time for both. That you know, again, there's these seasons of life, and the Bible recognizes and ordains and deals with these hard truths. And then here's the interesting thing. Is the last couplet there, a time for war and a time for peace. The reason I say this is interesting is everywhere else, as you go through this, like the concepts match up. Birth, death, plant, pluck up. Here, it's love, hate, war, peace. It reverses the order in the second couplet, and I think it does that for a couple of reasons. One is that there are seven verses here in these seven quads of concepts that are joined together. Seven is an important number in the Bible. It signifies like wholeness, our completeness, our perfection. And so the fact that we have seven quads, I think that he's getting to this like perfectly shaped poem, and the last word in it is peace, that he's arranging these seasons so that we end with peace. This is a beautiful thing. And so this is the end of his evidence. And I'm going to go through his conclusion here in a minute, but what conclusion are you drawing from it? Because like all art, how we interpret this poem depends as much on us as it does on the artist. Because all of us are in a season right now, good or bad. And maybe you're young enough that you haven't experienced many of these seasons yet, or at least not to their fullness, and you're filled with a bit of wonder and thinking like, man, I wonder what it's like to be in this or be in that. Maybe you're older and you've seen them all, maybe in all sorts of intensities, and it's causing reflection. Maybe you're in an intense season right now, and that's the only one that you can see. So, As we come to this, as we think about it, we have all these times laid out for us. And the preacher is going to conclude this with a question. Now in verse 9, so there's all these seasons, and he says, what gain has the worker from his toil? What does it matter if you act, if you work? You know, If you note, as you go through this poem, if this was a math equation, each one cancels itself out. Birth plus death equals zero. Breakdown plus buildup equals zero. And the seasons are arranged, and he comes to this jarring question at the end. He ends with peace, and he says, but what do you get for all of this? He throws a hand grenade into this peace that he just ended with. And I think he does this to get us thinking, because the preacher knows the temptations of his life. If all you see are the seasons, you might be tempted to think, well, it's all fate. There's nothing I can do. I can't stop it. I can't choose the seasons, so I'm just going to resign myself to the never-ending waves hitting the shore. Or maybe I can numb it with drink or sex or something, turn down the volume on this season, or I can turn to something to force a change that'll bring me joy and start putting my hope in seasons. Or maybe for once I'm finally having a good season. It's been a long spell of bad seasons. I'm clinging to that season. If all you see in this life are the seasons, your life is going to be as bleak as this question he asks, because we don't control the timing, we don't control the duration, we don't control the overlap of the seasons, because life is really complex, and you know, you may have a great season going at work, but a terrible season going at home or in various parts of your life. But like all of the book of Ecclesiastes, he's about to draw this contrast, this horizontal view of life that he's laid out in these seasons under the sun. If that's all we see, you know, we're going to try and succeed in the same ways he did in chapters 1 and 2 with gaining knowledge or accomplishment or pleasure. But he's about to go vertical in his view, and he's going to tell us two things he sees and two things he knows. So the things that he sees, I'm going to start with number 1 in verses 10 and 11. I've seen the business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. He has made everything beautiful in its time. That's the first thing he sees. That God has given us this business, and depending on your translation, you may say task or burden, this life, this toil, it's given by God. And that everything is beautiful in its time. If you think about it, the preacher is circling back to verse 1. He said in verse 1, everything has a season. And here he's saying everything is going to be beautiful, every season in its time. It's a provocative statement. You know, we're on the cusp of the best season in the world here in Oregon, berry season. This land of ours produces the best berries in the world. Strawberries, raspberries, marionberries, Oregon invention, by the way, huckleberries, blueberries, and any other berry worth having, we grow it better than anyone else. And if you love berries, you can look forward with anticipation to this season. And when it arrives, you can go to the U-Pick patch and make yourself sick before you fill your bucket and go pay, because that's how it works. And if you don't love berries, I don't have biblical proof of this. I'm relatively certain God still loves you. And it's America. You have the right to be wrong. But if berries aren't your thing, fill it in with whatever like does it for you. The point is this, that when the berry season is gone, it's okay, because we got to enjoy the peak of the season. And if it was here all the time, there wouldn't be anything special about it. And you can say, well, that's easy, Paul, but what about seasons of mourning and war and not embracing and loss? I don't see the beauty in any of that. You know, we won't see it often when we're in it. But I've preached a number of funerals, and it's definitely sad, but there is a beauty in how families comfort each other, how they put away petty differences, at least for a day, and come together, and how it focuses the mind of the living on the reality of death. Also, hard times in life have been incredibly formative. I can think of a time where we had a young family. We needed to move. We were outgrowing our house. We had just sold it. And we had an offer in on another one, but it was a bank owned it, and they were being unresponsive, and we were getting down to crunch time on getting out of the old house. And I had nowhere to go with my family. And we were looking for rentals, couldn't find anything that fit our needs and what we were after. And in the middle of this, my father-in-law does a church planning trip our church building trip, where they go and they do a bunch of work on the building of a church. Sometimes it's a remodel, sometimes it's new construction. But we've been doing it for years, and I announced it at church, and some folks went with us. And at lunchtime, I was sitting down with a guy that had come with us, and I really didn't even know him. He was a professor from California. They were up here on sabbatical. And we're sitting there having lunch, and he said, "Hey, how's life going?" And I was so stressed out, I actually answered honestly. Instead of just telling him everything was fine, like, "Oh, man, you know," and I told him what was going on. He goes, "Well, we're going back here to California in a couple of weeks. Why don't you just rent our house?" It's like, "Well, you got to understand, like, I've got a dog and kids, and oh, I don't care." "Okay, well, I might want it for a month. I might want it for 2 years. I don't know at this point." "That's fine." "Okay, how much do you want? What do you think's fair?" And like, by the end of that conversation, we had solved this problem that was just weighing me down incredibly. And that was a difficult, stressful, terrible season. But on the other side, seeing how God just provided what I needed when I needed it was incredible. For Cora and I, you know, the hard times of our marriage, where we didn't like each other a whole lot. We were committed to not getting divorced, but murder seemed like a potential option. That on the other side of that, like, I love my wife more today than I ever have. That hard times, although you don't want them, it's not fun at the time to be in the fire, that the most useful tools are forged in the hottest fires. And so one of the big questions of life, why is God allowing this terrible thing to happen? There's an answer here. He may be refining you. The Bible talks about how he refines you like a precious metal, scraping off the impurities. It may be that God's disciplining you. Maybe you're in a rough spot because you've made some choices that are questionable. And as Hebrews talks about, he's a loving father who disciplines us. It may have nothing to do with you, like the book of Job, where there's a spiritual warfare going on and you're caught in the crossfire. It may be that God's teaching you some hard truth so that as Paul teaches in 2 Corinthians, you can comfort others with the comfort that you've had in those times. There is a beauty and rhythm to these seasons of life given by God, and the preacher rightly points it out. And in the second half of verse 11, he also says this, "Also he has put eternity into man's heart, yet so that he cannot fully find out what God has done from the beginning to the end." You know, there's something inside of us that wants to know it all. We want to know what happened. We want to have that front row seat to watch creation unfold, see how the earth was formed. We want answers to the questions of this life. What was it really like on the ark? What's the real story with COVID? How much wood could a woodchuck chuck? And there's something that yearns to know the future. We want to know how this will turn out or that will turn out. We want to know how it's all going to end. It's going to be Biden or Trump. One of those fools is going to do it. But we want to know these answers. We have an ocean full of questions and a bucket full of answers. And even half the knowledge we have isn't all that great. How many goofy things can we look back on history and go, "Man, I can't believe that people thought that was how things work." Leeches for medicine? Who remembers Brontosaurus? Yeah, it doesn't exist. Not a thing. Or Pluto. It did something at the Christmas party, upset NASA. It's no longer a planet. Like, knowledge that we have isn't right. But we desire to know it all, and in a time and in a country where we think we can have it all, we'll just figure it out. It's just a matter of time. The Bible tells us we're limited. You know, I'm colorblind. There are things I can't perceive, no matter how much effort I put into it. Over the years, this has entertained my wife endlessly. When she first found out, we were driving around, she's like, "What color is that house? What color is that car?" And she's thought hilariously about the clothes I've matched up from time to time. And then when she's done mocking my disability, she goes and takes canes from people that need them. So she's a terrible person. But the point is that, like, there's things I'm never going to see because I can't. And God has put this desire for eternity in us, but also this limitation. And it's like a mystery or a book where you get part of the story, but you don't get to see it all. Yet God knows it all. The Bible tells us he's done it from beginning to end. This yearning should point us to God. And then the preacher has just got done telling us, I can't know everything, but I know this. He's going to tell us two things he knows. In verses 12 and 13. Some of your translations, mine says, I perceive, but the word is, I know. I perceive that there is nothing better for them than to be joyful and to do good as long as they live. Also that everyone should eat and drink and take pleasure in all his toil. This is God's gift to man. You know, we don't get that much time on this earth, but he's telling us to be joyful. Some of your translations will say rejoice or be happy. Psalm 118 puts it this way, this is the day the Lord has made. Let us rejoice and be glad in it. That there's something about being in this life that we should rejoice in. He says to eat and drink and take pleasure in your toil. I prefer the NASB translation on this, actually, that says, see good in all of his labor. The King James puts it this way, enjoy the good of all his labor. What's going on here? It's not just talking about enjoying food and drink for food and drink's sake. He just got done telling us in chapters 1 and 2 that that's an empty pursuit. No, he's saying this is God's gift. This echoes the command of the Sabbath, that work hard for 6 days and rest and enjoy the fruits of your labor on the sixth. I think he's telling us to enjoy the simple gifts that come from God daily. Cora's mom told her when she was a teenager, hey, you know what? No matter how hard things are, you can always come home and have dinner. That, you know, I don't know if you've ever had a hard day and walked in and dinner's cooking and maybe the crock pot's on, whatever, and it smells amazing, and how that just can change your mood and your day. That enjoying these simple gifts that God gives us changes your perspective on things. And maybe you're thinking, well, that's great, but my job stinks. I'm Jake and I work with a bunch of jackanapes. Well, the Bible talks about this too. I'd encourage you, if that's the case, read Ephesians 6, where it talks about doing your job as service to the Lord, knowing you'll be rewarded by God, that your work and your attitude at work in this life are your witness to others. That especially in times of difficulty, having that perspective and that heart will make you stand out. But he tells us our toil and its rewards are God's gift to us. And then the second thing he knows is the closing of our work in verses 14 and 15. I perceive that whatever God does endures forever. Nothing can be added to it, nor anything taken away from it. God has done it so that people fear before him. That which is already has been, and that which is to be already has been. And God seeks what has been driven away. He tells us that God's work is perfect and durable. That the one in charge of time knows what he's doing. If we compare this to the earlier verses, everything has a season. Things are constantly changing and shifting. And the preacher told us life's a vapor. It doesn't last, but everything that God does endures forever. It's complete and it's whole. And then his final verse there in 15 is similar to verse 1:9, where he tells us there's nothing new under the sun. He says, you know, what's happening now isn't special. It's happened before. What is happening in the future has happened before. And this language about what has been driven away, it depends on your translation. I wrestled with this one for a while, but I think that in context he's getting at, you know, the seasons are cyclical, and God's going to bring it around again. And these verses sum up the great contrast of Ecclesiastes, where our toil, our knowledge, our achievements are a vapor. They don't last, while God's work and knowledge and achievements are permanent and perfect. And the comparison, it tells us, should drive us to fear, or some translations will say awe, but the idea is that there's a healthy reverence for the disparity between our limited selves and who God is. So like a scientific study, as I said, he's hit his conclusion, and he correctly identifies that God is in control of time from the beginning to the end. And can you guys throw up that verse from Isaiah? This reminded me of Isaiah 46. That says this, remember this and stand firm. Recall it to mind, you transgressors. Remember the former things of old, for I am God and there is no other. I am God and there is none like me, declaring the end from the beginning and from ancient times things not yet done, saying my counsel shall stand and I will accomplish all my purpose. See, I think the teacher of Ecclesiastes is correct in his conclusion But he's missing one key piece of data, one piece of evidence that we actually have. See, for three chapters, he told us that there's nothing new under the sun, but he wasn't quite right. There was a season unique in human history that did change everything. When God himself came into this world to experience its seasons. Galatians 4 tells us this, but when the fullness of time had come, God sent forth his son, born of woman, born under the law, to redeem those who were under the law, so that we might receive adoption as sons. And because you are sons, God has sent the spirit of his son into our hearts, crying, Abba, Father. So you're no longer a slave, but a son, and if a son, then an heir through God. As a church, we just got done studying through the book of John, where God demonstrates his precise control over time and what the fullness of time means in this section from Galatians. In chapter 3, Jesus was at a party and the wine ran out, and his mom came and told him to do something about it. And he told her, woman, what does this have to do with me? My hour has not yet come. It's not just days and seasons. He controls the hours. In John 7, they were seeking to arrest Jesus, but no one laid a hand on him because his hour had not yet come. Going through the book, there's at least a dozen times, probably more, where he talks about his time, his hour was not ready. Until in John 12, he tells his disciples, and Jesus answered them, the hour has come for the Son of Man to be glorified. See, God in complete control from beginning to end, the one that ordains the seasons, did not spare his own son from a season of betrayal, accusation, torture, and death. It was the worst season in human history and the worst imaginable. And yet even that, God made beautiful in the incalculable fruit of that difficult season. In Romans 5, it tells us this, for while we were still weak, at the right time, Christ died for the ungodly. For one will scarcely die for a righteous person, though perhaps for a good person one would even dare to die. But God shows his love for us in that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. So I'm going to go ahead and call Brian and the worship team back up. And as I apply our text today, I'm not going to tell you what to think about this text, because the essence of Ecclesiastes is to provoke thought. So in that spirit, I'm going to ask some questions. I've got three of them. I'm going to give you some commentary on it. One is, as you are going through this life, are you exhausted by the seasons? Maybe you're living in verse 9 where he basically says, what does it matter? It's all a vanity and chasing after the wind. You know, Ecclesiastes was written by a guy who tried it all. And so if that's you, I'd encourage you to spend some time in the second half of our text this morning, or keep reading in the book, because if there is someone who gets it, he gets it. But it may be that you're stuck in the first half of our verses and you're missing out on God's greatest gift, the one that changes everything, your redemption in Christ, because we all need forgiveness. And I would also encourage you maybe to find an older believer who has seen some seasons in life, because I bet they'd be willing to share and walk through whatever you're going through with them. If you don't know any, come find me afterwards. I'd be happy to make introductions. Second question. This is a fun one. I want you to think of the worst seasons of your life, the most stressful, the most unjust, the most awful, and ask, can you see beauty in them? And if you can't, I would suggest reflecting on them this week and mining them for gold. Even if it's so horrible that you think there's no possible way that that's useful, I don't want to mentally go back there. God redeemed Jesus Christ on the cross. I'm pretty sure he can redeem the seasons that you've been through. And in times I've been low, to have someone come alongside me and say, man, I've been there. What a tremendous source of hope that's been in my life. And often the openness that can result, or if we are open with each other, that results in the beauty. God has put us in church for a reason, to do life with one another and to walk through those difficult times together. And sharing the difficulty in my life I'd say even especially when the season was caused by my own sin, man, I have seen multiple times others helped by my struggles. Because maybe they're struggling with something similar, maybe just knowing that, man, Betts isn't perfect for whatever reason was helpful to them. That ugly season is redeemed, and both of us get to see God working in our lives and get to see the beauty in it. I'll give you a caveat to this, though. It's only after the storm, usually, that we see the beauty. If you're in the middle of one of those seasons, I'm not saying you should see the beauty in it. But just knowing that it will be often provides you with a lot of hope. And number three, what seasons drive you closer to God? Are you the type of person that in a good season is filled with gratitude, and that drives you to God? Or maybe you're a person that's in a rough season. You find yourself asking for help and relying on him. And the converse of that is, what seasons drive you away? If it's a good season, do you tend to forget about God and, like Nebuchadnezzar, say, look at what my work and my hands have done? Or maybe in a rough season, you get angry at God or ask, why me? And I suggest thinking about this as you go through your week, because the truth is we all forget and our hearts are prone to wander. But if you have some self-awareness about what makes you wander, it can help you stay on the path. And it can help remind you that your hope isn't in the right season. Oh, when this season gets over, or that season gets over. It's in the good God who controls the seasons. So let me pray, and then these guys, I'll play a song, and I'll close this here in a minute. Lord Jesus, we thank you for your word. We thank you for the trueness of it. We thank you that you provide us with this deep and moving insight into your control and over time and the seasons. And we thank you that we live on the other side of the cross, where we are blessed with this knowledge that the writer of Ecclesiastes didn't have, Lord. So I pray for all those that are here that you fill them with hope as they go forth this morning, and thank you for your word. Amen.